This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week on Lost and Found Sound, NPR's collaboration with independent producers, we visit a small room that once existed in Midtown Manhattan, Studio 9 at CBS Radio. CBS broadcasters presented some of the most significant sounds of the 20th century from that room.
Probably no one spent more time in front of the microphone in Studio 9 than Robert Trout. Recently, he came across one of his long-forgotten recordings. It was a program in which he said farewell to Studio 9 almost 35 years ago.
In the beginning, news at CBS was sustained more by sheer pride than by money. It was a trade-off in which we consoled ourselves that the privilege of inventing our own rules was more important than becoming wealthy. In 1964, as Studio 9 was about to be abandoned, that pride still lingered. So before the wiring was ripped out and the soundproofing stripped from the walls, some of us thought it would be proper to say a formal farewell in sound to the birthplace of CBS News. I was host and narrator of that farewell. It seems curious, 35 years later, to reminisce on a reminiscence. As broadcasting facilities go, Studio 9 was not remarkable at all. It's not the handsomest radio studio,
not the most modern, not lovely at all. But for those who have worked here, it has a charm all its own. We shall miss it. The voices of those decades that have gone seem to be talking again, speaking words that once made people tremble and rejoice and laugh and cry, sometimes speaking words that will not die.
The trembling was almost audible during that last week of peace in 1939. Studio 9 suddenly seemed to come of age as Hitler's panzers gassed up for their strike into Poland.
Now let's hear from the German capital. To hear the chief of Columbia's Continental Staff, William L. Shirer, we take you now to Berlin.
Hello, America. Hello, CBS. This is Berlin. The sands are running fast. Tonight, we should have a decision whether it's to be peace or war.
For the next 25 years, Studio 9 would be a kind of clearinghouse for a procession of moments. They would defy precedent and give singular new meaning to that overused journalistic conceit, making history. The voices that reported and analyzed them became familiar to millions. Herewith a brief sampling, starting with the bland Midwestern twang of Elmer Davis.
We have a bulletin from Paris that the Polish ambassador has now formally notified Foreign Minister Bonnet that Germany has committed an act of aggression.
In the stadium in Chicago, the band plays Hail to the Chief as the thousands leap to their feet and cheer this climax of the 28th Democratic National Convention, now meeting in Chicago. The President of the United States has spoken from the White House in Washington, D.C., and spontaneously the convention breaks into God Bless America. Listen.
We have been on the telephone with our station KGMB, which is in Honolulu, and they report to us that the attacking planes number between 50 and 100, that the air raid is still on, and that the anti-aircraft fire can be heard in a steady drone as the attacking planes come in. We received a bulletin.
And now for the report of Richard Hodlett of CBS. Go ahead, London.
The Allied forces landed in France early this morning. I watched the first landing barges hit the beach exactly on the minute of H hour. I was in a 9th Air Force Marauder flying at 4,500 feet along 20 miles of the invasion coast. The weather is favorable for the operation. We were low, but we were...
This is Columbia's news headquarters in New York once again, and this is Bob Trout speaking. You've probably heard the news. I've been telling it to you for 15 minutes before. You've heard the news that the president is dead. We are slowly getting details, and as they come in, I shall give them to you. Columbia has canceled all its regular entertainment programs this evening.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully.
Let me interrupt that bulletin for a historic footnote. You've probably heard that flawlessly rendered recording many times. It seems to turn up in many documentaries. My greatest hit, as it were. But I have a confession to make. It's a fake. 3 years after the war, Fred Friendly and Ed Murrow were assembling a record album of historic events called I Can Hear It Now. But the surrender announcement just seemed too messy to use. So in the fall of 1948, Fred asked me to come into the studio and recreate a more sanitized version. Ever since, the recreation has been taken for the original by nearly everybody. And in the modern tradition of such shocking revelations, I have the tapes to prove it. Here is how it actually sounded that night in Studio 9.
Columbia's News Headquarters in New York, Bob Trout speaking. This is the supreme hour, 7 o'clock Eastern wartime. The correspondents of the White House have entered President Truman's office. The Prime Minister of Great Britain is about to begin his broadcast. And so without further ado, we take you now to London.
What came next were 40 agonizing seconds of dead air, save for the chimes of Big Ben. A switch to Washington produced only static. Standing next to me before the teletypes was my boss, Paul White, who was on a direct phone line to the White House.
Well, accepted.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington, and I didn't expect to hear a celebration here in our newsroom in New York, but you can hear one going on behind me. We switched to London. I don't know what happened. I'm not even sure whether you heard the first words of Prime Minister Attlee or not. I couldn't hear anything in our speaker here with the confusion. Suddenly, we got the word from our private telephone wire from the White House in Washington. The Japanese have accepted fully the surrender terms of the United Nations. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. It is not, of course, the official VJ Day, but the United Nations on land, on sea, on air, to the four corners of the earth and the seven seas, are united and are victorious.
After the war, the history of our time continued to move through Studio 9. Howard K. Smith reported the first civil rights stories from the South. I was at Cape Canaveral for the first manned space flight, and it was Alan Jackson who was on duty to report the news that no one wanted to believe.
Little Rock waited through a tense weekend to see what would happen on Monday when classes resumed and nine Negroes tried to enter Central High. The worst happened. Hundreds of Central High white students walked out of their classes when the Negroes showed up. The president acted. He federalized the National Guard and he ordered the 101st Airborne Division, a combat-seasoned unit, into Little Rock to maintain order and to see that the Negroes were allowed into Central High.
This is Cape Canaveral, where for hours on end now, astronaut Alan Shepard has waited alone, locked into the tiny Mercury capsule on the nose of the Redstone rocket.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition.
You don't hear the sound yet, but we see the flame. Very slowly, majestically, the Redstone rises into the sky. Its man invisible inside the capsule, and a flame clearly seen, like a beaming light, like a searchlight, focused down at the earth again as that thin, slim pencil goes slowly, slowly up into the clear sky. And now the sound grows louder and louder and swallows everything.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
President Kennedy and Governor John Connally of Texas were both hit by a would-be assassin's bullet as they toured downtown Dallas in an open automobile a short while ago. That is the latest word that had just come in from Dallas on United Press International. The Associated Press, in its first report, says that President Kennedy was shot just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy, who was riding with him, jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy and cried, "Oh, no."
35 years ago, most of the voices of Studio 9 could still speak for themselves, including Ed Murrow.
One of the infuriating things I remember about Studio 9 was that occasionally we would get through to Master Control, and then they couldn't get it down to Studio 9. And that produced some rather profane comments because we couldn't see why we could get a good signal 3,000-5,000 miles, and in New York they couldn't get it four floors.
I think the engineers are going to be slightly embarrassed.
Strangely enough, I had no recollection of that conversation until I found the transcription. We spoke by wire. I was at CBS. Ed was at his home in Pawling, New York. He seemed short of breath as he spoke. We all knew that he was ill with lung cancer. As we reminisced and laughed, I reminded him that I had been responsible for the first broadcast of his career.
This is a reminiscence that you'd ever care to remember, but it's always been my story. You remember the first time that you ever went on CBS on the air? We'd gone to the Christmas party of the publicity department, and somehow it stretched on into the evening, at least for us. And I was practically a teetotaler, you know. I didn't know anything about all this alcohol, and of course you were always very circumspect. And as the evening wore on, and I remembered I had to do a five-minute news broadcast supplied by the Press Radio Bureau, you decided that I really wasn't quite fit to do it. Do you remember that?
If this is being recorded, I don't remember anything about it. But
and I sat in the studio when I was supposed to be doing it, and you did it.
That's right, and you were going to give me the cut. You were going to give me the watch at the end, and you gave it to me a minute early, and we left 45 seconds of dead air at the end.
I don't remember that
That's
at all.
True.
I think that was your first broadcast on CBS.
It didn't occur to me then that I would also be sharing his final broadcast for CBS. In 1964, the second third of the century was drawing to a close. None of us knew then what the final third would hold. The Gulf of Tonkin was just weeks away. Then Watergate, men on the moon, the end of the Cold War, and a presidential impeachment. Today, as a semi-retired newsman, I'm occasionally asked whether I regret having missed being in the thick of all that. My answer is that I don't envy any journalist who has had to cover that impeachment. I'm satisfied that my years in Studio 9 coincided with the most extraordinary chapters in history ever written. I don't believe, as many like to say today, that those were more simple, more innocent times for broadcasters. Human behavior has never been simple. Ed knew that and said as much in our final conversation.
I'm wondering about your new quarters. I haven't seen them, but I'm wondering if they will make it any easier to know what to say and how to say it. I rather doubt it, no matter how fancy they are. What do you think?
I doubted it very, very much.
Veteran broadcaster Robert Trout.